Good morning from beautiful Washington, D.C. at the EMS Today Conference. And we're starting, what day is this?
Saturday.
Very good. May 8th. We again want to thank the GEMS Corporation in Penwell for having us here and for hosting our podcast setup, and Physio Control, who is sponsoring our podcast studio. This is the Disaster Podcast, our new podcast. I'm your host, Sam Bradley. I'm without my training wheels today because we're without Jamie, but I have my partners here from Paragon and my good friend, Andy Swartzel, so you get to know all of them. And we're going to continue our discussion of disaster EMS. So, Dr. Joe, you want to give us a quick intro on...
Sure. Glad to be here again. My name is Joe Holly. I'm an EMS physician and medical team manager for Tennessee Task Force 1, one of the federal urban search and rescue teams.
Okay. Jim.
I'm Jim Logan. I'm a paramedic from Memphis, Tennessee. I'm an officer with the Memphis Fire Department there and also a co-founder and co-owner of a Paragon Medical Education Group.
Andy.
Good morning, Sam. Andy Swartzel. I'm a Captain EMS Coordinator with San Ramon Valley Fire District. I'm also the Deputy Commander of DMAT California CA-6.
And Andy and I have been on many, many adventures together, some of which we will talk about. I am also on DMAT CA-6, by the way. But we were talking yesterday about preparation and how important it is, especially for our EMS providers, to prepare their families. And the discussion was, in some cases, you know when a storm's coming. But us out in earthquake country in California, we don't know what's happening. And in order to keep our people on the job, if they prepare their families appropriately and they know where their kids are going to meet up and they have some food stores and some water stores, then they're more likely to stay on the job, which is what we want them to do. So let's talk about disaster people. Now let's talk about, Joe, you've mentioned one of your favorite subjects is people that like to self-deploy, be them regular people off the street. We all know, we were talking earlier about the fact that when you get the same thing with USAR as we get with DMAT, is after a major incident, we get all of these people wanting to just pop in and join the team. And to be honest, I don't know that those people are going to stick around when they have to realize everything they have to do, all the training that's required. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think you're exactly right. That always does happen, and I think it seems to be a natural assumption that when some major incident occurs and people in their altruistic nature want to go respond to that all of us do that by going, hey, you want to go? Well, let's leave, and off we go. Obviously, the issue with self-deployment has many, many facets to it. Part of that issue is people who are totally unprepared to function in that environment show up and try to function in that environment to their own peril, in many cases to potential team member peril as well, and I think in many cases to patient peril as they get themselves involved in that situation. I think they have great potential to cause as much harm as they hope to benefit, primarily because they don't have the logistic support in place to take care of the logistic needs to be functional in those environments. And we've even seen, the natural tendency, especially if it's an incident that's close to home, to grab your equipment, whether that's your backpack or your fire truck from your local fire department, and rush over to the scene and end up parked in the way, as it were, thinking that you're helping, and in reality you're impeding progress. The other issue with that is kind of more of a systemic issue, in that those people appearing as sort of individual resources, if you will, have real challenges in that the system doesn't know that they're there. And I can think of several examples of, at Katrina, for example, a vehicle with a couple of docs and a couple of nurses from a hospital some hundreds of miles away literally filled a vehicle full of ACLS drugs and bandaging stuff and et cetera, and rushed their way down to New Orleans with no logistics, no food, no place to stay, no idea where they were going to go, and then were obviously very upset that they were, one, being told we don't need you, two, you're in the way, and sort of being turned away. And here's all this great effort that's gone into people trying to come help, yet the system couldn't figure out what to do with them because they weren't a complete package. They, in essence, right, became someone who needed to be taken care of, not someone who could provide care. So,
Andy, you deployed to Ground Zero, to Katrina, and good, and any number of other places.
Yeah, and Joe, I think your point are well taken. Not only are they probably not well prepared logistically and have the support staff, but many of them don't understand that disaster medicine is different than their day-to-day operations. And I mean, in your lecture the other day, it's clear when you're not prepared, when you don't have the resources you're normally accustomed to, transport, then you might actually be jeopardizing patient care. And a source of frustration for those people who are well-intended, come in thinking that they're going to operate like they normally do on the day-to-day situation. As you all know, it's a different environment entirely in that situation.
It's truly a safety issue. And as you guys are talking, I'm thinking about each deployment that I've been on. Every single deployment has that problem. You know, people are you know, good natured generally, right? And they want to help, right? When things of national significance happen, a disaster, an emergency, whatever. I'm thinking back on it's a safety issue for the patients, for your team, because you get not just the medical response, as Joe was talking about, but just from the citizens wanting to do something good. I remember getting on a boat in Katrina during the flooding and going out and getting patients and bringing them in. And I think it was later in the first day that we were doing that I was by the guy that was driving the boat. And I said, leaned over to someone, I said, "Do you smell whiskey?" I said, and he said, "Yeah." So what was happening is these boats were coming and people were just bringing their own John boats, their air boats, things like that. Very well intended, but you know, the stress of a disaster gets to people, and so it was a safety issue for us being on the boat as a team. But there are ways for people to seek out how they can fit into the system, which is, you know, the system works if you allow it to work.
Well, let's talk about that. What are some of the teams that people can engage with? So, not people may assume you need to be a medical provider, which isn't always the case. We have to be careful because we don't want to do the acronym podcast.
Okay.
Jamie reminds us of that because he's our only non-disaster person. And yesterday we're talking USARS and DMATS. He goes, "Okay, you want to explain that?" So we're going to have a little acronym soup here, but starting with a CERT. Mm-hmm. A CERT is a Citizens Emergency Response Team. Mm-hmm. This is like your neighborhood level.
Right. Mm-hmm.
These are people, and they learn a variety of skills. They learn some basic first aid. They learn how to dig somebody out of rubble. They learn how to turn stuff off. So it's just a whole cadre of basic skills where within a neighborhood, they're like that first
team,
contact,
right?
The people that know what to do when maybe others don't know what to do.
It's a 16-hour course. It's usually taught at your local fire department or Office of Emergency Management, and it's usually free, right, to get people plugged into the preparedness. And so it prepares you to help your neighborhood to be self-sustaining during an emergency or disaster for about 72 hours. But it's an interesting concept, right? But I think we do a poor job sometimes of letting our rescuers know what a CERT team is, right?
This is true.
And
yeah.
So that's something that you know, we can talk about later, what that is and what that looks like and how you can integrate that into your system. To be helpful with, like, you know, windshield surveys and damage assessments,
absolutely.
Things
yeah,
like
and
that.
We really do want to talk about integration, because when you have a big incident, you have a lot of, and a lot of the podcasts we've had this week, there's been that constant theme of integration, of EMS integrating with public health and integrating with police. So now we're at that same concept on a different level, and you're right, they'll all be there, even though time-wise, your CERTs are usually the first ones there, and then maybe your medical reserve.
Medical reserve corps is another.
MRC.
And MRC.
MRC.
I decided to define it first.
That's right.
An MRC.
Well, I mean, I think it started at the federal level, but basically what MRCs do is try and develop through a registry, a list of healthcare professionals and others that can be called up and utilized in times of disaster.
And surge, basically.
Surge and they're proliferating. I know in our area, the Bay Area, we have a number of MRCs and like we now have these CERT, Citizen Emergency Response, other people call them, the MRCs. The issue is, you know, trying to work together with them and trying to train so that there's an understanding of what their capability is, right, what our capability is, and everybody's competing for the same dollars in training. Yeah. And so sometimes we're not collaborating, I think, as much as we should, mm-hmm, and then expecting that when a disaster happens that, you know, CERTs and DMETs and USAR teams are automatically going to be
Red Cross.
Red Cross, you know, the NGOs that come in, faith-based mm-hmm organizations, all of a sudden somehow have to try and work together.
Sure. That would be non-governmental organizations.
Well, and that we work some things on the state side, yeah, which is kind of the next level. And I remember the big wildfires in San Diego in 2007, and of course we were there. I don't go anywhere without Andy. And we did have that transition from the Red Cross that was basically, yeah, working that site. Now, that was kind of interesting. And then when the DMATs came in, so that was kind of unusual, especially in a state mm-hmm incident. But it became federal. We needed the federal support mm-hmm on it. And we can talk later about how that whole hierarchy of requests have to go in order to get right those teams. Do you have a state team?
We have several different state teams.
Yeah.
You know, on the USAR world, you know, we're a federal asset, but
right
obviously we can be utilized by the state just like you guys can as
much
well.
Much like us, yeah.
Yeah, and then there are some sort of regionally based state-level USAR teams that are in various levels of development and readiness, as always, but are modeled after that federal system.
Well, I do want to have more discussion about the USAR and the DMAT. I mean, it's quite an ordeal to become an employee of a federal organization, but it looks like our time is just about wrapping up for this first segment.
Wow.
I know, that was fast, wasn't
super
it?
Super fast.
It's when you're having fun. Yeah. But it just shows there's so many things that we can talk about relating to disaster. But I do want to continue this conversation because we want people to know what resources are out there and how they can gain access to them. So it would appear we have to wrap this up. So again, thank you for being here. Thank you for watching. We'd love you to go to our website, disasterpodcast.com. That's not hard to remember. We'd love to get your comments. We'd love to hear about what you would be interested in learning about. So again, we want to thank the GEMS Penwell Corporation for having us here and for Physio Control for sponsoring our studio. And we hope to see you soon. And I'll leave you with this thought. This is not your everyday medicine.